You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is actress Sharon Gless. You know her as Sergeant Christine Cagney in the police procedural drama Cagney and Lacey, for which she won two Best Actress Emmys. She also starred in The Trials of Rosie O'Neill and appeared on television in Queer as Folk, Burn Notice, and lots of other great television shows and films. And she's just written a memoir. It's called Apparently There Were Complaints. Sharon Gless, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you.
So you didn't really become an actor until you were 26 years old. Is that right?
I admitted at 26 that I wanted to be an actress. And by almost 27, I was signed to Universal Studios. And I was there 10 years as a contract player.
So, I mean, that's kind of the end of the contract years, I guess, right?
I'm the very last contract player in the history of Hollywood. I was the last player to leave the lot.
Wow.
The contract system ended.
And was it that old style 7-year contract where they would give you a raise or fire you every 6 months or something?
That was it. Yes, and every 6 months we'd come up for review. And then after 2 years, you'd come up for review annually, yearly. But there was a time when I was going to be thrown out on Lancashire Boulevard, which is the street that Universal sits on. And Robert Wagner saved my career.
He's so great.
He's wonderful. I went and auditioned for him for kind of his silly secretary in a series called Switch.
I remember it well.
Yeah, with RJ and Eddie Albert. And it was supposed to be a lookalike, a Natalie Wood lookalike. Well, check it out, you know. But I went on the interview anyway, and he was so charming. He was so lovely, and I blushed appropriately because it was Robert Wagner. And he read with me, and I got the part that day. That kept me at Universal. Otherwise, they were going to throw me out.
What did you do for your first 26 years that you weren't pursuing your acting career?
Well, I went to school and was thrown out of a Jesuit university. It's probably easy to do. But I never finished my college career. And I was became a secretary, because in those days I realized a woman couldn't earn a living unless she had some sort of typing skills. Either if you want to be a lawyer, I mean, you had to be able to type. So I went to secretarial school at night and worked at the Seattle Credit Union during the day. And I ended up working always behind the camera. I was a secretary and production assistant for different film companies. And while I was assisting in casting for some of my bosses, I would read with the actresses. Mm-hmm. And I thought, gee, I was pretty good. And then I made out their paychecks. I said, wait a minute. And I stopped being afraid. And I said, I can do this. Yeah.
Yeah. And the doors opened for you. Because why? Because you had the connections already and you were beautiful, but
no. Oh, please. Thank you. Bless you. My uncle was a casting director in the business, but he didn't believe in nepotism. So, and my grandfather was a big lawyer in the golden days of Hollywood. And he was Howard Hughes' attorney and Cecil B. DeMille's and Louis B. Mayer's. And he said, you stay out of it. It's a filthy business. I didn't have the nerve to ask him, well, you've been in the business, Grandpa. anyway, so I studied finally. When I stopped being afraid, I started studying, and I did a little play. It only ran two nights and we didn't charge anybody. It wasn't my greatest triumph, but it was. Because I made a mistake in the play. I missed my cue and I had to come on stage with my costume half off. And it looked like I'd been getting laid in the back. And it got the same laugh you're giving me right now. And the next day I got a call at my office where I was a secretary from a man from Universal Studios. He said, I saw you in your play. You're a wonderful comedian. I said, I didn't want to say that was a mistake. And he said, I want you to meet Monique James, the head of our talent department. And every actress in town knew who Monique James was. She was the woman who discovered people and brought them under contract. And I said, okay, cut the bullshit. Who is this? I thought it was one of my friends. She said, I can understand you being skeptical. He said, I can understand you being skeptical. Why don't I have Ms. James call you? And I said, yeah, do that. And damn it, she didn't call me. And I went in and I prepared a scene for her. And she signed me that night to a 7-year contract. I lasted 10, but it was her guidance. It was her guidance that got me really where I am today, getting to talk to you about this book.
Well, I'm fascinated by the time that you spent on television before you landed Cagney and Lacey. And I've been going back and watching some of these. I saw you in A Haunted House on Ironside the other day.
Oh, please don't hold run that film.
you look so beautiful. You're the prettiest girl in the show. Sure.
I saw that piece of film recently and I thought, I don't know why they even kept me under contract after that. My voice sounded so small, but
it was a kind of a ridiculous show, but
yes.
I don't want to jump ahead, but you know, actually one of the things that I think is so remarkable about Cagney and Lacey, when you look at some of these older shows like Ironside, I mean, there was some quality television all the way along, but Ironside was a really popular show. It was on for like 8 or 9 seasons and it's terrible. It's so wooden. The acting is so stiff and it's so unrealistic. Whereas, you know, Cagney and Lacey felt like we were really there. Well,
years later, it was almost another era by the time Cagney and Lacey came on. And then Cagney and Lacey set a brand new tone. Yeah. There had never been a show starring a drama starring two women before.
But wait, before we get there. Okay. So you were doing a lot of television and you did some shows that I watched a lot, like Owen Marshall, and you were a regular on Marcus Welby, MD, with Robert Young.
That's the show that almost got me fired from Universal.
Because why?
There was no chemistry between James Brolin and me. It was certainly not his fault. I just didn't have what they needed for that character. I was supposed to be his new love interest. And they gave me a terrible hairstyle and matronly clothes. And I was running this family practice center for the Marcus Welby people. And there was just nothing between James Brolin and me. He's a very nice man. But clearly I wasn't his type. And it was just full. So they fired me, as they should have.
They wrote you out. Did they kill you?
They didn't fire me. I mean, they just wrote me out of the... I stayed a year and they just wrote me out and brought in a very pretty, sexy girl with a lot of hair. And, you know, and I believe those characters got married on the show.
Right. I was pleased in your book that you mentioned Elena Verdugo, who was a regular on that show and who I loved, and I loved in other things because she was very beautiful and wonderful. And she was a friend of yours too.
Very, very dear, one of my bestest friends. She just died a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yes, I was sad. And I loved her. I think that, you know, that show wasn't her greatest. She actually brightened up that show quite a bit.
Oh, I think so.
Because she was so good.
She never missed a day of work. And that show ran for how many years?
Oh, it was on for 8 or 9 years too, yeah. Right?
She never missed a day of work, never missed a cue, nothing.
What about Robert Young? What was he like to work with?
Very nice man. I did 2 TV movies with him before I got Marcus Welby.
Ah.
There was a TV movie called All My Darling Daughters. And Robert Young in person has 4 daughters. And this was a movie where all his daughters get married on the same day. And the wedding coordinator The wedding coordinator was Eve Arden.
Oh, wonderful.
How fun is that? And then the TV movie was such a hit, they did a sequel called All My Darling Daughters Anniversary. And so I went back and worked with Mr. Young again, playing my father both times. And we just hit it off. And so I think he asked that I be on his series, the Marcus Welby Show.
That was nice.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, I, of course, I loved him on Father Knows Best. When I was a kid, I used to love that show, Father Knows Best.
Yes.
And I love Eve Arden, you know, Armis Brooks. And
oh, my God. I was so besotted by her. Yeah. When I met her, I just went up and I just said, oh, she was in Should I'm Eve? And I said, oh, Miss Brooks, you know, I mean, Miss Arden. I probably did say it was. I said, oh, Miss Arden, I said, this is such a treat for me working with you. And she was very, very modest and, you know, say, oh, stop. But she meant it. You know, she's a very just terrific pro. You know, she knew we were all young, the ones who were all playing as daughters. And she absolutely treated us like we were gold.
I saw you in a TV movie the other night that I was looking for, in which you played a telephone operator taking a call from a kidnapper. It was called The Longest Night. And David Jansen.
The first time I was ever on film. I'm sorry. That was the very first thing I ever did that aired on television.
Ah.
Was that scene.
Yeah. And you're good in it. You're very good in it. Very convincing. And David Jansen is in the picture. And I'm a big fan of David Jansen's. And
Was he in that picture?
Not in any of your scenes, but yeah, he's in that picture too. James Ferentino, you.
Oh, about the girl who was buried underground?
Yeah.
I was so nervous. I was so nervous when I did that one telephone operator scene that my voice broke. I have a husky voice anyway. My voice cracked. And I thought they're going to make me redo it because I'm taking the information about where she's buried.
Yeah, where they buried her, right.
True story. It's an actual true story.
Yeah.
Where she was buried. I was so nervous. My voice broke. And I thought they were going to make me reshoot it, understandably. They said, no, we love it. She's so emotional that her voice breaks.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We return now to our conversation with actress Sharon Gless. She has a new book. It's called Apparently There Were Complaints, a memoir.
Sharon Gless, in your book, Apparently There Were Complaints, one of the things that I love about your book, and, you know, a lot of people who've written memoirs, they have stories to tell, but they don't want to name names. They don't want to say, oh, this person was this or that. But you don't have any problem naming the names of these people that did whatever they did. And you talked about David Jansen in your book, and you said that he was loaded.
Yeah, but I wasn't putting David down.
No, but you say he was drunk. The
tone I used, not at all. He was a lovely guy. I just was fascinated. I said, David, you know, you're drinking a vodka on the rocks every morning in makeup, and yet you do these incredible monologues, long, long monologues, without paper, nothing, no cheat sheets, nothing. I said, how do you do it? He said, oh, honey, I've got a photographic memory. I don't have to memorize them right there in my brain. Isn't that fascinating?
That is fascinating.
Like his brain.
Do you think it's true? Is it possible?
I guess so. He did it.
Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah. Oh,
Margaret O'Brien. Remember the child actress, Margaret O'Brien?
Yeah, of course. Certainly.
I worked with Margaret one of my first jobs at Universal. And Margaret told me this, a child, she had a photographic memory. She said, I really didn't know. I mean, I didn't have to memorize lines yet. She was a child. But they'd read it to her and her mind would absorb it and she never needed to look at it again.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I could never learn any lines. That's why.
I always had actors. I like Tyne Daly and I would run lines every night before we would perform the next day. And I've always needed to run things at home and get very comfortable with them before I take them on the set and try them out.
Yeah. Well, so it was never a problem for you. You just had your lines down.
Oh, no. I went once on stage in London.
Yeah.
I was working with Tom Conti and a little bit of Gorgeous. And it was a Neil Simon comedy. And it was just the two of us on stage. And it was a phone conversation. And I couldn't remember my next line.
Wow.
Well, thank God it was a phone conversation. It was a Saturday matinee. I always knew this. There was a Sharon Gliss fan club there that used to come every Saturday. Thank God. And I couldn't remember the line, so I just said, "What?" I'm on the phone, and I can see Tom going, "Oh, he doesn't know our line." And he repeats his line for me. I still can't remember my line. So I say, "I can't hear you." And in the wings, of course, the stage manager is whispering the line to me. I'm so nervous I couldn't hear her. And then I said, "I'm so sorry. Could you say it again?" And someone from the audience yelled my line to me. Some wonderful fan who had been there every Saturday yelled my line to me.
Did you break the fourth wall and thank him?
In the phone, I said, "Thank you."
Oh, that's the actor's nightmare, isn't it? To be on stage and not remember your name.
Oh, my God. It happened to me again on stage when I was doing Misery in the West End.
Oh, uh-huh.
With Bill Patterson. Of course, he's in a coma and I'm the insane nurse. And I have all this monologue I'm supposed to say to him as I'm tucking him in, and I'm just rattling on and on because I'm so excited he's there. And I can't remember part of my monologue. And Bill Patterson is supposed to be in a coma. And he lifts up one eye open, looks at me, says, "I can't help you." So I just jumped a paragraph. When you're playing Eddie Wilkes, she's so wacko that you can kind of go.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, with Neil Simon, it's like you can't miss a line because then you miss a laugh. I mean, all the words are rhythmic in such a way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you about acting for television. I know you're a friend of James Gardner, and you mentioned him in your book, and he's one of the exceptions to the rule. I mean, David Jensen, I think, wanted a film career, but never really made it in the movies. But James Gardner is one of the few people who can move freely between television and the movies in his long career. And I wonder if there's a difference. Is there a difference in the way that an actor approaches a television role than the way they appear on stage or in screen?
Well, not that I know of. I mean, I think on stage you have to project.
Certainly.
But emotions are true or they're not. You know, in the case of James Gardner, he just had a wonderful, easy talent. He was a Southern boy and he just had an innate style that was his. And he was nominated for his series. He was nominated for his last motion picture. He just had a gift. And he was so kind on the set, and his crew respected him. I learned a lot from him. Sadly, I didn't get to work with any women, really, until Tyne Daly.
Yeah.
In the early years of my career, all television series were starring men.
And they were all written and directed by men.
That's right.
Until
correct.
Until Cagney and Lacey came along.
Until Cagney and Lacey.
And I was very pleased. I mean, you and Tyne Daly, you're like the Simon and Garfunkel of television.
Well, thank you. I'll take that.
Yeah, and I mean, people are so excited to know that you guys are friends, and you said in your book that you talk to her every day. That just warms our hearts. We're happy.
I just had dinner with her last night.
Oh, that's so great. And
my pal, we didn't have time to be friends
when you were doing the show.
We were colleagues, certainly, and looked out for each other, but we never hung out together. We didn't have time.
I was watching, Sharon Gliss, the episode, the two-parter, Turn, 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 in which you won your Emmy Award. And there's a scene in which you are sitting in a hospital waiting room and you're talking about the death of your father. And it's a long scene. And Tyne Daly is next to you and she says one word or something. But other than that, it's you for a longer period of time than we would ever see on TV today. They would never hold a camera just on an actor and just let them act the way you did in that scene. There's no cut. There's no other angle. It's just you. And it's so natural. It must have been very, very difficult to do. Did you take more than one take?
Well, interestingly enough, my father was dying, my own father. when I was shooting all that material. But I don't use my father dying. You know, I mean, you can't do that. I really talked about Charlie Cagney.
Yeah.
And they wrote it in a way where when you talk about someone, it was a shock, you know, she found him that way.
Right.
And the next scene is her sitting with Mary Beth. And oftentimes there are pauses. You don't know how to get to the next line. I don't mean I knew how to get to the next line, but yeah. In real life, you know, and the writers allowed for that. And they wrote it as Mary Beth, who's also a fabulous listener. Just let me talk. And I don't even remember what I said in that scene, but I remember Cagney was in shock.
It's an amazing.
I don't remember scene. It being a weepy scene at all. I think she just talked.
It's not the kind of thing that you see on television in general or in the movies either. I mean, it was a very realistic and wonderfully done. But so did you do it in one take or did you have to do it again?
I don't remember. I don't remember. Occasionally I'm able to do things in one take. I don't know if that was one of them. I'm always criticizing myself. I'm always asking for another take. But in all of that, Charlie's death and all the drunk stuff, I just went with it.
Let's hear a little bit of that scene from Cagney and Lacey, for which Sharon Gless won an Emmy Award as Best Actress of the Year.
Paramedics said he was dead when they got there. But I didn't believe him. You know, sometimes you hear stories about those patients who die on tables and 15 minutes later they just come back to life. Miracles happen all the time, right?
All the time.
And I wouldn't let him ride in the ambulance alone either. What if he woke up, you know, and wondered what was happening? Charlie plays tough, you know what I mean, but he gets scared. I've seen him really scared, so I held his hand the whole way so that he'd know I was there. And his hand was warm, it wasn't cold at all. When we got here, the doctor said that he was dead too. I said, that's it, there's nothing we can do. I said, well, that's my father. Would you just walk away if it was your dad? Made a lot of noise. And they started, you know, working on him again. 10 minutes. 20. But he wouldn't wake up again.
What happened, Chris? Do they know what happened?
A cerebral hemorrhage, they think. He fell somehow. I don't know. They were at that damn coffee table. That's where I found him, by the table. I told them so many times, be careful of those corners, that they were dangerous. And he always used to say, Christy, what do you think I am, 2 years old? You know, Charlie, is he so hard-headed?
That was Sharon Gless from Cagney and Lacey. And we'll hear more of my conversation with Sharon Gless right after this. You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is KSCO. We'll be right back. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And this week, my guest is Sharon Gless. She has a new book out. It's called Apparently There Were Complaints, a memoir. In addition to starring as Cagney in Cagney and Lacey, Sharon Gless also portrayed Rosie O'Neill in The Trials of Rosie O'Neill in 1990. Here's a little moment from that series.
I'm thinking about maybe having my tits done. I don't mean I want them any bigger. They're a nice size, actually. I just thought maybe I'd have them fluffed up a bit. I don't know. Maybe I'll just grow my hair. What time is it? I don't want to spend any more time talking about Patrick. It's my nickel, right? I think I'm wearing a lot of red lately. Patrick hated me in red. So for 10 years, I never wore it. Now, everything I buy is in red. You know what? I don't even like red. Why do I let him do this to me? I thought I was doing better. I think I'm doing better, don't you? Well, I think I'm doing better. I mean, I know I started smoking again, but it's because I was eating so much. This girl that he claims to be in love with is petite. Probably has firm breasts, too. But hell, who doesn't at that age? Bastard. You know, it's been almost a year since he asked for the divorce. Why do I still have a pit in my stomach every morning? Why haven't I unpacked my moving boxes in 4 months? Why do I still park my car 5 blocks from work?
Why do you park your car 5 blocks from work?
It's a Mercedes. You think the guys I work with now can afford a Mercedes? You think it's right to defend indigent clients all day long and then bomb on home in an $80,000 car? Think it's wrong? Do you ever talk? What the hell am I paying you for anyway? Sorry. Really, I'm sorry. I know these things take time. Does my neck look crepey to you?
Do you like your new job?
What?
Do you enjoy your work?
Yeah. A client spit in my hand. I offered my hand to her, you know, assuming she was going to shake it. She spits in it. But I'm happy. I wonder when it was he decided he didn't love me anymore.
That was my guest, Sharon Gless, author of Apparently There Were Complaints, a memoir, from her television series, The Trials of Rosie O'Neill. That was the opening monologue to the pilot episode from 1990. Sharon Gless, when you did the episode of Cagney and Lacey that we were listening to before the break, that was an episode where you sort of descend into alcoholism, and you used a lot of physicality in your acting.
I was not drunk when I did those scenes.
Yeah, but
the press said, was she drunk when she shot, you know, this episode? And I was not.
Yeah.
Maggie Smith told me once, she said, honey, you can't be drunk and do that kind of work.
Yeah, yeah.
And I told her, well, this press is saying is life imitating art. And but it was so beautifully written when Barney showed me the script where they were going to start dealing to see Christine in her apartment, the scenes you never see.
Right.
Of her real alcoholism. She was always, you know, kind of a fun drunk and stuff, but you never saw this tragedy. And he shot everything in sequence for me. So I could remember where I'd been and where I still had to go.
And, you know, in a police...
You, may I say just something? You commented on the physicality of those scenes.
Yeah.
There was one part where I find out that Mary Beth is having a party for herself because she got promoted, and I'm so loaded, I forget to show up. So I go over to my closet, which are those sliding glass doors. And I told the director, I said, look at this. Here's what I want to do. And I went to the closet and I just let the closet slide open. And I went with it and went right on the ground. I thought it was hysterical. And she said, no, I'm afraid you're going to hurt yourself. I said, no, I won't. But she wouldn't let me do it.
No. Well, I mean, there's a fine line between drama and comedy, right? I mean, Lucille Ball on Vita Vita Vegemin is also getting drunk and it's hilarious.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and a lot of the stuff you did on Cagney and Lacey was hilarious. I mean, Cagney and Lacey was a drama, but it was a very funny show.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Yes, sometimes it was.
And what was also unusual about that episode that we were talking about, Turn, 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 is that it's a police procedural kind of show, and all of a sudden we're in your home and dealing with your personal way that the show hadn't really done before.
But you mean the drunk?
Yeah.
Yeah, when Barney showed me the script, I said, "This is amazing. Who are you going to get to play it?" it was such powerful material, and that was the 6 years that we were on the air. No other woman won the Emmy, and it's not because we're so brilliant. We had the material.
It's so great, isn't it?
Writers.
Yeah. You know? But Tyne Daly won it several times before you did. Did that?
Yes, she did. She won it three times. And then I won it twice. And we sort of thought maybe I'd win it the third time so we could tie, but it went back to her.
Oh.
and honestly, I mean, we joke about it. And it was much easier losing to her than losing to somebody else. She was my partner, and she always said, you know, we hit the ball to one another. Somebody's got to hit it back.
So. Yeah, right. I mean, you guys played so well together. And the whole ensemble of the show was great. I mean, when you think of cop shows before Cagney and Lacey, I mean, there were some that were kind of leaning in your direction, like Police Story was one. But if you think of the Dragnet or Adam 12 kind of shows, not that those shows aren't enjoyable, but they're not real.
You know, I did one of those.
Yeah, you did a couple of them.
Directed by Jack Webb. He said, "I'm his Harry Morgan." Do you remember his partner in Dragnet? Right. Mm-hmm. And Frank Sinatra Jr. played Jack.
Yeah.
And he did Jack Webb, directed Frank Sinatra Jr. and me as a Dragnet team. It didn't sell, but.
Oh, too bad.
Be working with him.
Frank Sinatra Jr., was he any kind of actor? Could he act at all?
Yes, he was a fine actor. I think he was a better singer. Yeah. I thought he sounded very much like his father.
Yeah, he had a nice voice.
Very sure. Nice voice and a wonderful musician and a really terrific human being. I think being Frank Sinatra's son was not easy. You know, but... He was a very kind man. I ended up in Vegas one night and I couldn't get a hotel room, and he was there and he let me sleep in his living room.
Wow.
Dr. Junior, and I'm hanging out, you know, sleeping in his living room.
What about Jack Webb? Was he a good director? I know he directed.
I love Jack Webb. Stuff. Now, I'll tell you something.
Yeah.
I don't know how much time we have, but you can
cut
and paste him.
Yeah.
Jack, I did this pilot with him, and Jack had a very specific way of directing, and he had a very specific way of you wanting to deliver your lines, and I wanted to deliver it my way. And it's the last line of a scene, so I deliver it my way, and he said, "No, I want a little more rhythm to it." I said, "Okay, oh, I get it. Okay." So I did it again exactly the way I wanted, thinking he wouldn't notice, and he'd say, "Perfect, print it." I know. This isn't my youth, moment of arrogance. Anyway, 17 takes.
Wow. Took.
Gary, 17. He wasn't going to be fooled.
No, you need
finally, to. Finally, at take 17, I've never done that many takes in my life. At take 17, I said, "Well, I'm just going to imitate the sing-song way he wants me to say it." He said, "Perfect, print it. Lunch, everybody." He never got mad at me. He just sort of sat there. She'll get it. Eventually, she'll get it.
Well, he had a rhythm, too, that he was going for.
Oh, very much so.
Consistent in all of his work, that kind
of. Yes, and that's what he had wanted me to do, and I was trying to sort of be more natural. And, you know.
Yeah.
But he told me a secret. He said, "Do you want to come to the dailies today?" You know, where you see yesterday's work.
Yeah.
On the big screen at Universal. And I said, "Well, contract players aren't allowed in the dailies, Jack." He said, "Why not?" I said, "Because the big, heavy hitters from the tower, the big executives, are in the dailies, and they want to be able to say how bad you are and not be feel intimidated because you're sitting in the room." He said, "Oh, honey," he said, "it doesn't matter. You can come because every frame that I shoot goes on television." He said, "I edit as I'm directing."
Hmm.
He said, "There's not one frame that ends up on the floor."
Wow.
Yeah. That's how precise he was.
Yeah, he was a fine actor, even though I think people don't realize it. But especially if you listen to the radio version of Dragnet, he's terrific on that.
Oh,
it was a show where people talked a lot, so it was a great radio show, but it was maybe not as great a television show.
I didn't know it was a radio show.
Yeah, Well, I'll have to send you some. You would enjoy listening to that.
I would. Yeah, I love radio. I do radio.
Lee Marvin was a regular. He was the bad guy on all of them. He was a different bad guy, but he was on all of them.
Oh, great.
Because it was radio. You could have the same bad guy.
Sure. Yeah. I love radio. You don't have to look your best.
I have a face for radio, personally. When you started to do Cagney and Lacey, one of the great things about that show is that there were so many women involved. I mean, the episodes that we were talking about were written by women. And
Right. Well, we had male writers also, but we had a nice female staff also of writers and female directors.
Yeah.
Two or three female directors, which was unheard of in those days. We had some female crew members.
Wow.
Yeah. We're talking the 80s. You know, there just wasn't a lot of that around.
There were shoulder pads, though.
And shows. That's right. I was always wearing men's jackets. Cagney.
I knew they looked good.
Thank you. they started out with me in, you know, skirts with high-heeled boots. And I said, what? I'm running down an alleyway after a perp? And I catch my boot in the hem of my... That's not going to fly. So I ended up changing my Cagney's look.
Yeah. And you met your husband while you were working on the show.
I did. Well, he didn't become my husband until 10 years later. But yes, he was our executive producer. The original idea for the two women was his. In fact, he was the first feminist I ever met.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you still feel he's a feminist?
Oh, yes.
All this time.
The problem with being married to a feminist is he says things like, you want equality, open your own door. I go, well, yeah. But I can, no matter where my work takes me, he never complains, saying, no, aren't you home? Never, never once has he ever done it.
So you're not gay? Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No. Sorry. I know.
Why do you think it is that everybody thinks Sharon Gless is gay?
Well, it started with Cagney. I think there was a very large lesbian following. Thank you, God. And everyone just assumed that Cagney was gay. She had men in her life. She slept around. But there was an edge to her. And I think some cliches that people think are gay, they saw in her and assumed she was gay. So I had that following. And I know where you're heading with this. You're heading with my Rosie O'Donnell story.
Well, only if you want to.
Yeah, no, I don't want to.
but it's a wonderful part of
it. They can read it in the book.
Yeah, they read it in the book. And that, you know, you did Cagney and Lacey, and then you guys did some movies, four movies, right? You did some reunion movies.
We did four reunion movies, right? So Menopause Years, they were called.
So far.
Well, so far, I don't hear it. Leslie Moonves killed the franchise of Cagney and Lacey.
Yeah.
It was the new president of CBS, and he didn't like women over 20.
Right.
Like young girls in his series. I won't go there with the rest of that line. I know that.
We all know what happened.
Very well. I know. Yeah. Leslie and I were in acting class together.
Yeah. Did he ever approach you in an unsavory way?
I don't want to go there either.
Okay. Well, what about in general? I mean,
he didn't like Cagney and Lacey. He said he thinks Cagney and Lacey was a fluke. Mm. I mean, it was, one of the highest rated shows in television. But that was just his belief. So he killed the franchise of Cagney and Lacey after the four movies. Barney had an idea of doing one movie a year for CBS of the older cops.
Yeah.
But anyway, it didn't happen.
I think now you could do a movie where you guys are, you're on a cruise and there's a murder. And
I think they did that. Wasn't that Love Boat or something?
Sharon Gless, the book is called Apparently There Were Complaints, and it's a wonderful book. And you wrote it. You didn't have a co-writer. You just dove in and wrote it?
It took me 7 years. Find a ghostwriter who'll hang in for 7 years, right? I came up with the title first. And that informed me. So I knew, I remember every complaint about me throughout my life. But it took a long time, and you always have help, you know. But it's my words, and it just took a long, long, long time. We never do these things alone.
Well, it's brilliant, and thank you so much for writing it and for sharing your life with us. I feel like we're best friends now because I know everything about you. And it's also really a great thing for me to have admired you for so many years and get a chance to sit with you and talk with you. So thank you for being with us.
You made it very pleasant, very easy for me. So anytime.
Actress Sharon Gless, her new book is called Apparently There Are Complaints. Here's Sharon Gless and her Cagney and Lacey partner Tyne Daly performing a song called You're Nothing Without Me.
You are some gumshoe, you just don't think well. Get this dumb gumshoe, we're from the same inkwell. Where would you be if you had no me there? Can't you see people think we're a classic pair? Who's Lacey without Cagney? Time, let's be honest here. That show was just a drag scene. So I saved your bacon, my dear. You are so jealous of my track record. Darling, do tell us your feeble hack record. Your big boobs, brand new blonde and unstable. Cancel you and you fold like a card table. You envy my credentials. When was it you last scored? Go lift up your essentials while I go get my next award. Yeah.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.